This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Boots Riley wrote and directed the new movie Sorry to Bother You. It's a social political satire starring Lakeith Stanfield, one of the stars of Get Out and the TV series Atlanta. This is Boots Riley's first film, but he's had a long career as a rapper with his group The Coup, a self-described revolutionary music collective. Their music is on the soundtrack of the film. Riley grew up the son of political activists who moved from Chicago to Oakland when he was six. His grandmother ran the Oakland Ensemble Theater. Sorry to Bother You is set in Oakland. It takes aim at corporations that underpay or otherwise exploit workers. It's also a story about race, relationships, and conscience. When the movie begins, Lakeith Stanfield's character is broke and living in his uncle's garage. He talks his way into a telemarketing job, but everyone he cold calls hangs up on him. An older, more experienced telemarketer, played by Danny Glover, offers some advice. Use your white voice.
Hey, young blood, let me give you a tip. Use your white voice.
Man, I ain't got no white voice.
Oh, come on, you know what I mean. You have a white voice in there, you can use it. It's like when you were pulled over by the police.
Oh, no, I just use my regular voice when that happens. I just say, back the f*** up off the car and don't nobody get hurt.
All right, man, I'm just trying to give you some game. You want to make some money here? Then read the script with a white voice.
When people say I talk with a white voice anyway, so why ain't it helping me out?
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. I'm talking about the real deal, like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer, this is Langston from Regal View. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
That's a scene from Boots Riley's new film. Boots Riley, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Whose voice was that we heard as Danny Glover's white voice?
Well, there's a rumor that that's Steve Buscemi, but it definitely is not. But it's not.
Oh, that makes sense. I can hear that.
It's not him.
It's not
actually.
Him?
No. I'm just saying that's a rumor and someone wrote it on Wikipedia, and that's what people get for reading Wikipedia as fact. But no, it was just our engineer. He did a scratch take and we liked that a lot, so we kept it.
I didn't know about the Wikipedia.
No,
rumors,
I thought that that's why you were asking.
No, because I didn't know. I knew that Patton Oswalt did one of the voiceovers.
David Cross does Lakeith Stanfield's voice, and Patton Oswalt does Omari Hardwick's voice.
I don't want to give away spoilers in the film. So I'm going to ask you to do your brief synopsis of the film without things that you don't want the audience who hasn't seen it to know.
Yeah. Okay. This is an absurdist dark comedy with magical realism and science fiction inspired by the world of telemarketing. It's called Sorry to Bother You. In it, Lakeith Stanfield plays Cassius Green, who's a black telemarketer with self-esteem issues and existential angst, who discovers a magical way to make his voice sound like it's overdubbed by a white actor. That white actor is played by David Cross. Hilarity ensues.
Well done. I like the way you shot the opening telemarketing scenes where Lakeith Stanfield's character is calling people up. And visually what happens is like his desk and him sitting behind it basically crashes into their home, into the person he's calling, into their home as a kind of metaphor for how intrusive the call is. And he's interrupting people's lives. He's interrupting like a couple having sex. He's interrupting a woman whose husband has like stage 4 cancer. And he comes on and says, sorry to bother you, you know, and goes into his pitch. How did you come up with that visual image? Is that how it felt like when you were doing telemarketing, that you were literally crashing into somebody's home uninvited?
Well, definitely it felt intrusive. And the whole situation is awkward. And what I tried to do in this movie is, one, give the audience the same emotional feeling that the character was supposed to be having. So that called for visual inventiveness. And in this case, I wanted the two people to be in the same room and So I put them in the same room. And I think us doing that early on in the film allowed people to accept a lot more. And that's what I did throughout. Every time I needed something for the audience to go through something emotional, something that had to do with the larger philosophy that I have or anything like that, I bent the reality of that world.
So you're also a longtime rapper with your group, The Coup. And before there was the movie Sorry to Bother You, The Coup released an album with that title. What's the relationship between the album and the movie?
I finished writing the script. I got to the end the first time in 2012. And I needed a way to get a buzz going about the script because I didn't know anyone in the film world. So I made an album that was inspired by the screenplay. It's been so many years since we put that album out that we actually made a new soundtrack album, which is by The Coup, for the movie. So that will also be coming out in this summer.
So I wish we could play music from the soundtrack of Sorry to Bother You, but since it's not going to be released until later in July, I thought we'd hear a track from the album Sorry to Bother You, which came out in, what did you say, 2012? Yeah.
Yes.
So this is a song that I think provides a similar energy to the song that you use on the soundtrack at the beginning of the movie Sorry to Bother You, and it's called The Magic Clap. You want to say a few words about it?
Yeah. And as far as that energy, I'd like to, you know, I tried to go the intellectual route and say that I needed this visceral energy for this or that. But also, we're a performing band, and we need shows that rock the crowd. And so we need songs that rock the crowd. And that's also the reason for songs like this. But this song is talking about that moment when theory turns to action, that moment in your brain. And for purposes of this song, we're calling it The Magic Clap.
Okay, so let's hear The Magic Clap from the 2012 album, Sorry to Bother You. And this is The Coup, and you'll hear my guest, Boots Riley, who wrote and directed the new film, Sorry to Bother You.
Come on, kid!
That's music from the 2012 album by The Coup, Sorry to Bother You, and Boots Riley, who is the producer and rapper in The Coup, has now made a film called Sorry to Bother You. You became a rapper. You were in the music world before you were in the film world. So I think you always knew you wanted to make movies. How did you end up being in the music world first?
I was at film school in San Francisco State, and at that time, the school was more, I found it to be more focused on experimental film and documentary. I was interested in narrative and things that could reach many people. And going to school in San Francisco, you're not going to meet as many people that are making films as you would if you went to film school in New York or L.A. So we got a record deal where they were actually offering me money to do music, to do my art. So I quit school really quickly and did that instead. We just happened to be at the right time in the right place because the Bay Area, specifically Oakland, was a place that every record label decided they needed a group from. So we rode that wave that was started by people like Digital Underground, Too Short, and MC Hammer.
Your grandmother ran the Oakland Ensemble Theater. Did she inspire you to want to do theater or to perform?
Yeah, I think as a kid that was addicted to TV, she maybe thought that that was a way to get me away from the TV, to say, well, you could do what they're doing there. And so it was acting. I would be around her sometimes when she was doing, they did Flash Gordon, I remember that. And there were just a bunch of people that were always creating, and I went on auditions with her. I remember that was the first time I met Danny Glover. I was probably like 10, and there were auditions going on, and I recognized him because he had already been in stuff. But yeah, I became part of another theater group that was called the Black Repertory Group, and it was just in a storefront in Berkeley, and there would be just one person plays coming through, and we would help them happen. But I think that's how I got into film. Was I also at the same time was an organizer? I became an organizer and helping out farm workers to organize a union, and so I saw the opportunity to fuse art and movement building, but seeing storefront plays made me think that maybe that wasn't the most effective thing to do. And at the same time, Spike Lee was out. So I got really excited about the idea of doing film instead.
So you met Danny Glover through your grandmother.
Actually, that's how I met him the first time. But him and my father have known each other since 1968. They were part of the San Francisco State strike together, which created the first school of ethnic studies in the United States.
So did he remember you when you asked him to have a brief role in your film?
Well, I've known him, so...
Oh, so he didn't have a chance to forget
he's
you.
he's a family friend, yeah.
He's a family friend.
And but he was the last person to sign on, I will say that. And that's because to him I was his friend's son with the script. And so and I'm sure so many people approach him with screenplays all the time.
And with their son's screenplays.
Yeah. So but he, even though he was the last one to sign on, he's probably the most enthusiastic about it. He's sat through 6 screenings and is always laughing the loudest at the movie.
So give us a sense, like when you started performing, what else was happening in the rap world when you entered it?
Well, so our lyrics were seen as political. And I say seen as political because they were. However, I think that all of this stuff is political. Everything we talk about is political. And only the things that disagree with the status quo are called political. And which ends up kind of lying to us, because then we think that the status quo is what should be or is what's regular. And it stops us from thinking. Anyway, so it was at a time when supposedly political rap was over with. This was years after Public Enemy had been out. And also, we didn't fit the mold of what people thought West Coast rap was supposed to sound like or talk about. So their labels always had a hard time putting us into a genre that they could easily sell.
So, before you made your new movie, your first feature film, you were in a lot of music videos with your group, The Coup.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a hand in directing the music videos? Because you wanted to be a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. So, at first, we were on a big label. You know, that was my thing. I was like, I went to film school. The label would say, okay, if you direct the video, since you don't have experience, you know, here's your budget way down here. And if you let this other person direct it, then you've got a budget way up here. And wanting to promote wanting to get the best video possible, that's what we went with, was the other directors. But I, you know, was very involved in that, again, from the treatment to camping out in the editing room. And I did co-direct one video, which is an 8-minute long story song called Me and Jesus the Pimp in a 79 Granada Last Night. And where we had Roger Guinevere Smith play Jesus the Pimp. And yeah, so I did that. And then, you know, with some of our other videos, I was involved in various ways, but no, only co-directed that one.
Did the music videos that your band was in help prepare you at all for making your new movie, Sorry to Bother You?
Well, I'll tell you what, I told investors that they did. But it's a different art form. And there were all sorts of things that I just was worried about that I didn't know. Like, okay, if you have a scene and there's 12 extras going up and down the street, who's the person that tells them to go and stop? You know, little things like that. So a lot of those questions also got answered because I took part in the Sundance Labs and then forced people to be my mentors in other cases.
So you're very political as a person. Your music is political. The film has a lot of political messages in it. Your father was very political as well.
What do you mean by political? Who
that is he political? He was a civil rights activist. He worked with the Panthers. I mean, like, yes. Literally involved.
I agree with you. I'm
activist.
Just kind of.
I should say political.
It's just a
activist.
Pet peeve what people call it.
Yeah, I understand. Your father was an activist, and there's even a photo of him with Malcolm X and Floyd McKissick, who'd been the head of CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality, one of the big civil rights groups from the 60s. Yeah. What does that photo mean to you?
I think it represents his legacy of being involved with civil rights movements and fighting for change. He joined the NAACP at the age of 12 and like started the Durham, North Carolina chapter of the NAACP at that age. Meaning there was nobody in Durham and they needed somebody to start it there. And later joined CORE and came to San Francisco. So that picture really says a lot for me. He was moderating a debate between Floyd McKissick and Malcolm X, and he was 18 years old. So him, you know, it shows me a driven young man.
So your haircut looks like you could be in the Panthers in the 60s. Just kind of big afro with kind of kind of like early 70s big sideburns. Are you trying to make a statement with your hair about your connection to that period?
I think when I first got it, I got sideburns because I, you know, in my early 20s, I looked like I was 12. The sideburns helped out with that. And after that, it's just because, you know, I got used to it. And actually, times when I wanted to change my hairstyle, I knew that so many people knew us from music videos and didn't necessarily know the name of the group, but knew it was that dude with the afro, that I knew that me being on the cover with that hairstyle let a lot of people know that this was our album. But yeah. I do think, obviously, I like how it looks because I would change it real quick if I did. It makes my nose smaller.
Now we're getting to the real answer. You're very anti-capitalist, and now you're in the movie industry. You stand the possibility of having a movie career and actually making a lot of money. What have you promised yourself about how you'd handle money and fame if you get it?
Well, I have so many plans of things that I need to do, projects and things that some are art-related, some are, you know, having to do with other grassroots campaigns that a lot of that. And I've also gone 20 years without any money. That a lot of that money is going to be gone as soon as it comes to me, if it does, knock on wood. But the rest of it has, I've just got so many plans that I don't have to make promises to myself of what I personally spend, because I have these other projects that the money will go to.
Boots Riley, it was great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Boots Riley wrote and directed the new film Sorry to Bother You and fronts the hip-hop band The Coup, which did music for the film. HBO begins an 8-part miniseries this weekend called Sharp Objects, based on the novel by Gillian Flynn, who also wrote Gone Girl. It stars Amy Adams as a troubled newspaper reporter who returns to her small hometown to investigate the disappearance or murders of a series of young women. Our TV critic David Bianculli says, Sharp Objects begins with some very familiar trappings of the mystery genre, but then becomes distinctly and disturbingly unique. Here's his review.
The basic framework of Gillian Flynn's Sharp Objects would seem to be leading us down a very familiar path. You've seen it all before. A young girl goes missing, then another is found dead. The story's hero, sometimes a cop or private eye, in this case a newspaper reporter, returns to his old hometown to investigate. Behind every door and every cryptic conversation are dark secrets. But our hard-boiled, hard-drinking hero is persistent, even when old memories and new conflicts bubble to the surface. It's classic modern-day film noir. Until it isn't. For one thing, and this is central and crucial, the protagonist in Sharp Objects is a woman, not a man. Already this TV season, we've seen another familiar genre, the spy story, flipped and re-energized in BBC America's Killing Eve by having women playing both the hunter and the hunted. Last year, on the HBO miniseries Big Little Lies, we saw a murder mystery untangle very slowly, as we spent time getting to know the private, sometimes sordid lives of some seemingly happy suburban women. The 8-part Sharp Objects is directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, who also directed Big Little Lies. And the star, playing the best role of her already impressive and varied career, is Amy Adams. In the movies, Amy Adams has played everything from a Disney princess come to life in Enchanted to an untrustworthy femme fatale in American Hustle. But in Sharp Objects, she plays something new, startlingly new. She plays a reporter named Camille, who is dispatched to make a reluctant return to her small Missouri town to investigate what may be the work of a serial killer preying on teen girls. The clues and the facts come slowly, but it quickly becomes clear that Camille left town long ago for some very good reasons. And though she got away, she's still haunted by her past and keeps it at bay with some very destructive behaviors. She drinks too much, keeps to herself, and engages in self-mutilation, cutting words into her own skin, then hiding them from view. She's hurt, angry, and isolated. And as she tries to solve her mystery, we try to solve hers. Also working the case is a visiting police detective, played by Chris Messina, who played Amy Adams' husband in the much lighter Julie and Julia. In this scene, they encounter one another at the local bar. He's there to keep tabs on one of his suspects, the teen brother of one of the victims. She's there to drink, at least until she too learns about the brother. But before she can approach him, the detective steps in.
You don't think he is?
Funny girl.
Come on, you know I'm going to get the story one way or another. Wouldn't you rather be in control of the conversation?
That's a good line.
Maybe, but it's true.
Well, looks like you're about to go talk to young Keene over there.
Oh, is that who that is?
Yeah, reporters aren't supposed to talk to minors without parental permission.
Jesus, I was just going to hit on him.
Oh, that's different.
So is he a suspect?
No, I can't answer that.
So he is.
Everybody's a suspect right now.
So that's it? You don't have any leads, nothing?
Camille, can we just talk? I'm starved for some city folk conversation. I'll ask you a question about your life. You're gonna ask about mine.
Yeah, I don't really do that. Chat.
Got it. Okay. Well, Camille, enjoy your evening.
Detective.
When it comes to dealing with the regular town folk, though, Camille is much more vulnerable. The people who knew her as a kid treat her the same way they did then. Her fellow former cheerleaders are just as cliquish. The boys, now men, are just as boorish. And her mother, Adora, beautifully played by Patricia Clarkson, is just as theatrical and controlling. She's like a character from a Tennessee Williams play, only with more bite and more venom. And Camille, reverting to old roles and patterns, eventually caves under the onslaught.
I'm happy you're here. But please, don't embarrass me. Not again.
What?
When you're here, everything you do comes back on me. Understand?
Honestly, no. Because that might have been true when I was a kid, but I'm an adult now.
Not in Wingap. When you're here, you're my daughter. You can move away and forget, but I can't. You don't know the people here anymore.
Yeah, believe me, I do.
I haven't heard from you in months. And you just show up asking such horrible, morbid questions, stirring everyone up, staying out all night.
Look, Mama, please, stop, Mama. Look, stop, I'm sorry, okay? I'm sorry.
Like Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl, her Sharp Objects unfurls its deepest secrets very deliberately, and characters are never quite what they seem. This TV adaptation, written by Marty Noxon and others, depends a lot on visuals. Images, almost subliminal ones, give us flashes of what's haunting Camille. But the meanings don't fully reveal themselves until deep into this miniseries. Yet, as time passes, we experience life from Camille's viewpoint in an intimate, very unusual way. Scenes involving sex and or nudity are both more tender and more painful than we usually see them, with more than just carnal emotions brought to the screen. And even during simple conversations, Camille's responses are complicated and raw. The performance by Amy Adams in Sharp Objects is like the childhood memories of her character of Camille. Intense, haunting, and entirely unforgettable.
David Bianculli is editor of the website TV Worth Watching and the author of The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is proof that science and facts can defeat political lies and cover-ups about the environment and public health. But her story is also about irreversible medical damage. Mona Hanna Atisha is the pediatrician in Flint, Michigan, who proved that children in Flint were being exposed to lead in tap water. How she discovered that lead was in the water and how she proved it is the subject of her new memoir, What the Eyes Don't See. She writes, "This is the story of a government poisoning its own citizens and then lying about it. It is a story about what happens when the very people responsible for keeping us safe care more about money and power than they care about us or our children." She adds, "It is also a story about a breakdown in democracy, the disintegration of critical infrastructure due to inequality and austerity, and environmental injustice that disproportionately affects the poor and Black." Dr. Mona, as she is known, is a pediatrician at Hurley Medical Center, a public hospital in Flint, and a professor of pediatrics at Michigan State University. Dr. Mona, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you first recognize that there was a problem in the water?
So it was not in the clinic. It was not by seeing patients. It was not in the hospital. It was at my house. I happened to have two high school girlfriends over. We were hanging out with our children, lots of little kids running around. And one of my high school girlfriends happens to be a water expert. She used to work for the EPA. And she, with glasses of wine in both of her hands, she's like, "Hey, Mona, have you heard about the Flint water?" I'm like, "Yeah, you know, there was bacteria, but, you know, that was cleared up. And then there were some other problems, but that was cleared up." I'm telling my patients that the water's fine. They keep asking me, but, you know, the state says everything's okay. Everything must be okay. And she turned to me and she said, "Mona, the water isn't being treated properly. It's missing something called corrosion control." And I had no idea what she was talking about. And she said, "Without that corrosion control, there is going to be lead in the water." And that was the very first time at my home, in my kitchen, glass of wine in my hand, that I heard about the possibility of lead in the water.
And your friend knew this because she had worked at the EPA.
Absolutely.
And had seen an EPA memo. Tell us about that memo.
Yeah, so my friend was formerly with the EPA, and she was with the EPA about a decade ago in Washington, D.C., when Washington, D.C. had a very similar lead and water crisis. So she very much knew about the consequences of lead and water. And she had seen a memo released by one of her former colleagues, Miguel Del Toro, out of EPA in Chicago. And in that memo, he warned that Flint was on the brink of a lead and water disaster and they needed to take action.
So was it the EPA memo that enabled you to make a connection between lead in the water and the symptoms you were seeing in the children you were treating?
Sure. So I did not see any symptoms in the children I was treating. Lead has no symptoms. So I love to trick my medical students and my residents, like, how does a child with lead poisoning present? And it's asymptomatic. They have no symptoms. So we have to be kind of on alert and do screening to see if there is any exposure. So when I heard about the possibility of lead in water, when I read that EPA memo, I tried to get the data to see if our children's blood lead levels had changed since the change in the water source.
That's so interesting that you don't see any symptoms, because the symptoms are what? Cognitive, other brain-related symptoms over a long period of time?
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the reasons why the title of my book is What the Eyes Don't See. So our eyes do not see lead in water. So lead literally in water is invisible. It's odorless. It's tasteless. But also the consequences of lead exposure is something we don't readily see. It impacts at a population level cognition. So actually drops the IQ of a population of children, shifting that IQ curve to the left, where you have more children who need special education services, less gifted kids. It impacts behavior, increases the likelihood of things like attention deficit disorder. It's been linked to impulsivity. It's been linked to violence and even been linked to criminality. So lead exposure has these lifelong cognitive and behavioral consequences that you do not see right away.
Once you realized that there was lead in the water, or that you suspected that there was lead in the water, you had to do some scientific research to present evidence that something was happening. What did you need to do to create the kind of study that you could bring to the authorities and say, look at what's happening?
Yeah, so I knew that I needed proof of impact. I needed to find out if that lead in water was getting into the bodies of our children. As pediatricians, we routinely screen children for lead exposure. We do this at the ages of 1 and 2 for high-risk groups, especially children on Medicaid, because Medicaid serves as a proxy for poverty, and these are some of the highest groups that are exposed to lead. So I knew that in my clinic, we screen children for lead. And I knew that in other clinics in Flint, they also screen children for lead. But I also realized that blood lead levels are part of statewide and countywide surveillance programs. So we have several programs that are designed to kind of track things, track epidemics, track, you know, flu rates and HIV rates. And lead is one of those things. We have surveillance programs already designed for blood lead levels. So I tried to get that blood lead data both from the state and from the county health departments, but had roadblocks at every direction.
Why?
So then, I have no idea why. There was so much denial in the Flint story. So much information was hidden from those who tried to get the information. I wish that was readily shared to me. And I wish I had known that even at that time, even when I started asking for this information, the health department at the state level had actually already looked into children's lead levels and on their own had already seen a spike in children's lead levels. I wish that was out there. I wish that was shared. I wish that was transparent, because then our crisis wouldn't have gone on as long as it did.
So some authorities knew and did nothing.
Absolutely. And that's why we have so many criminal charges right now.
Mm-hmm. How many people are being charged?
Over 15 people have had criminal charges brought against them, including negligent homicide charges. Not only was this a crisis of lead exposure, we also had one of the largest outbreaks of Legionnaires' disease. It's a pneumonia that older people get. At least 12 people died from that. There was also an uptick in general pneumonia deaths, mortality, possibly due to Legionnaires' disease. And because of that, there's been charges against folks at the health department and the water department, one of the emergency managers, for negligent homicide.
So you managed to get your hands on medical records of many children in Flint, and to show that there was an unusually high number of children with lead in their blood. Your research was discredited. How was it discredited?
Yeah, so we found that the percentage of children with elevated lead levels increased after the water switch, and this was contrary to everything that was happening nationally, statewide, and in the city. Publicly shared this data, which is very atypical of a physician. And in academia, you're supposed to present your research in publications and journals, and this was kind of a form of academic disobedience. But our kids did not have another day. That process takes a long time. So we publicly shared this data at a hospital press conference, warning families and children to take precautions and to not use this tap water, especially for our youngest and most developmentally vulnerable. And just as Mark Edwards was attacked, I was also attacked. So the state said that I was an unfortunate researcher, that I was causing near hysteria, that I was splicing and dicing numbers, and that their numbers, the large data set, that surveillance data set, was not consistent with my numbers. So it's very difficult when you're presenting science and facts and evidence to then have the state say that you are wrong. And it's hard not to second guess yourself. When I was writing this book, I was reliving those emotions that went through me during that time. You know, I just wanted to hide under a cover. I'm like, you know, this whole state, you know, their whole, Department of Health and their team of epidemiologists and those folks who have even more numbers than I do are saying I am wrong. And maybe I am wrong. Maybe I should not have spoken out. Maybe I should not have been doing this work. But finally, despite that kind of that setback and pushback and being discredited and the research being discredited, I realized as a researcher that these numbers that were part of my research, the facts, every number in my research was a child. And it was that realization that these were children we were playing with, and it was their future that was on the line, that really gave me that fight back to say, hey, no, these numbers are right. We have checked and triple checked, and we didn't even have to have evidence of children with increased lead in their blood. It should have stopped when we knew that there was lead in the water, and that's kind of what pushed me and gave me my fight to continue on.
This Flint water crisis has been so expensive in every way, in terms of children's health, parents' anxiety about their children, the actual dollars that continue to be needed to change all the pipes in Flint, the medical costs of treating the children. And this is going to go on for a long time, for years.
It's a long-term issue.
And it all happened in an attempt to cut costs.
Absolutely.
Explain a little bit about the emergency managers that Governor Rick Snyder put into place in cities like Flint that were in debt.
Yeah. So Flint was in a near bankruptcy state, really suffering from crisis for years, if not decades, before this water crisis. And in Michigan, if you're in kind of financial dire straits, the state can come in and really usurp democracy. So in 2011, Flint became under the control of state-appointed financial emergency management. And that emergency manager's job was austerity. It was essentially save money no matter what the cost. And they decided that the water that we had been getting for half a century from the Great Lakes, fresh, pre-treated Lake Huron water that we had been buying from Detroit, was too expensive. And we would start drawing water from the local Flint River until a new pipeline to the Great Lakes was to be built. So the move to the Flint River was a temporary move until a new pipeline was to be built. And this was all done to save money, to cut costs, with no regard for public health or children's health. And the folks who grew up in Flint, like, know the history of the Flint River. I mean, we are a legacy industrial community. The Flint River has actually caught on fire twice in the past. But this wasn't actually the corrosion or the impact of the water crisis was not because it was not the Flint River's fault. The Flint River probably would have been okay, not ideal, if it was treated properly. And the greatest irony is that the treatment chemical, the corrosion control, would only have cost $80 to $100 a day. That's all it would have cost to properly treat this water. Yet that was never put in this water. And the pump to install that treatment was actually never installed. So there never even was an intent to treat this water properly.
Was that a function of ignorance or austerity, financial austerity?
That is a great question, and I think that's why we have so many investigations. People are trying to get at the fundamental of why. Why was this water not treated properly? And I have no idea why. Many people point to this as an environmental justice issue, that it was because of the demographics of the population that this crisis happened and was prolonged and that these people were neglected for so long. I don't know if it was laziness. I don't know if they just wanted to kind of slide by until this new pipeline was to be built, that, you know, nobody would notice if it wasn't being treated properly. But, you know, I would love to find out the answer, and I look forward to even more investigations as to the why.
You write that by 2013, half of all black citizens in Michigan were living under an emergency manager, compared with 2% of white residents. So it's half of all black citizens, 2% of white residents, which you say meant that half of the black population in Michigan did not have elected representatives running their cities. The cities had been effectively colonized by the state.
Grossly undemocratic.
So is the water coming from Lake Huron again now?
Yeah. So just a few weeks after our press conference, we switched back to treated Great Lakes water. However, for the 18 months that we were on this corrosive untreated water, it damaged the infrastructure so much. And that is why people had to remain on filtered and bottled water until the pipes were replaced.
So you are a pediatrician in Flint, Michigan, where people are still under an advisory to drink filtered or bottled water. What about those of us who aren't an advisory, mm-hmm. under an advisory? What advice would you have for us about drinking tap water?
Yeah, I feel like I've taken a kind of crash course on water chemistry and drinking water quality over these last few years. And what I have learned is that the regulations on the books do not fully protect children. The lead and copper rule, which is part of the Safe Drinking Water Act, has not caught up with the science that we now know, where there's no safe level of lead that's allowed. So for children in Flint and for children everywhere, especially if it's a pregnant mom or a child up to the age of 5, I recommend filtered water if you really want to protect that child. Until we have massive investments in the infrastructure to get the lead out of our plumbing, until we have strengthening of regulations, I would recommend people take additional precautions.
Okay. That doesn't sound great. So you would be drinking bottled or filtered water no matter where you lived in the U.S.?
Yes, we were stubbornly slow as a nation to restrict lead in our plumbing. We didn't restrict lead in our service lines, which are the water lines that go from the water main to your house, until 1986. But we actually didn't restrict lead in our brass fixtures until 2014. So, for example, Flint schools didn't have lead lines, but they had some of the highest water lead levels. And that's because the fixtures were leaching lead. And every week, almost, we hear about another community or another school district all around our nation who is testing and finding lead in their water, because there is lead in their water. So these are some of the great positive ripple effects about the Flint story, is that, you know, people thought we took care of lead. People thought it was a problem of yesterday, but it's a problem of today and it's a problem of tomorrow. And we're fortunate that people are now paying attention to it.
Dr. Mona, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you so much. It is, like I said before, an honor to be here on here with you.
It's an honor to have you on the show.
Thanks a lot.
Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha's new memoir is called What the Eyes Don't See.